Can the pain and suffering from my ancestors be felt in my life? How important is it to know the story of my relatives and family, ancestors? I mean, there's different ways to answer this probably, but one, I think that we probably, the most easiest way to understand it is that your parents had parents who had parents who had parents, and if there were traumatic events in the history of your ancestors, they're going to pass that on to their children in one form or another, just because they're themselves carrying it. So if they're carrying it, they can't help but pass it on. And then also they may be carrying it and have worked through it in a positive way. And so even though the pain is being passed on, there are also maybe some values and some empathy being passed on. What comes to mind is a man who went through the Holocaust and survived it. He must have been very young, as all his family were killed in the Holocaust. And now he's going around the world trying to save the animals, farm animals, because he feels that they are in a Holocaust, which they are, actually. And so he's lecturing all over the world and comparing what his family went through and what the human race went through to what, like, the animal farm animals are going through now. And so it's converting, having pain, but also converting your pain into something useful. And you find that a lot also with, say, if people have an ailment and they're able to survive it, they'll teach others how to survive it or to get well. Or if they have a child who has, for instance, I know of a situation where their child had muscular dystrophy. And so then they did so much work. The child finally died when he was about 20, actually. They did so much work for muscular dystrophy. Christopher Reeves, who, you know, broke his back with a horse in that horse riding tournament, did so much work to help people who had that type of injury. It's still going on to today. So that's how we tend to positively transform our suffering and pain. The whole thing gets passed on down the line, you know. So in that way, whether or not the suffering of our ancestors is passed on in any genetically in any way, there's been some new studies that are intimating that may be the case. That not only is there the genetics of just biological genetics, but that something is actually held and passed on an emotional level, not just through our communication of our emotions, you know, from parent to child, parent to child. So maybe both are true, you know. Now, on a positive note, they say that even in the Bible it says that your behavior, you know, blesses or curses seven generations ahead. But in the Vedanta, it says, if you have knowledge, if you gain self-knowledge, you're jnani, because that's considered the pinnacle. There's nothing more than that in the Hindu tradition. Gaining moksha is really the pinnacle of what is able to be gained. So if you're so blessed as to gain self-knowledge and you've done all the punya and everything that gets you into a position to gain it, that will actually bless and affect all of your ancestors seven generations back and will bless seven generations forward, you know. So that type of thinking is so much in the culture. I mean, in the world. It's a mythological, almost. It's something... It's an understanding that is held, at least in myth, in so many different cultures. So there's something significant there. And the idea of seven generations, you know, like say if you commit some sort of a papa, it takes really seven generations to get to totally wash that away from your family line. So punya would be the same way. So anyway, that's all I can say about it. Sometimes I can feel a bit bitter when I give and share and love without getting anything back. Even though I give and expect nothing in return, in the long run, it becomes draining. How to deal with emotions like bitterness? We have the bitterness because we do want something back, you know. So, which you may not feel that you do, but you probably do want something back. So I think the anecdote to that is the assimilation of the understanding that, in a sense, I reap what I sow immediately. Like, for instance, if you're being kind to somebody, you reap that kindness. They experience the kindness, but so do you. You know, if you are loving, you experience the love, so do they. If you're caring, you experience the care, so do they. So you're giving, if you're generous, you experience the beauty of that generosity, so do they, you know. And you experience it right away also. So your very giving blesses both the one who receives and the giver as much as the one who gives. And so that is the beautiful reward. And the opposite is also true. If you're mean to somebody, you experience that meanness. If you're small-minded, you experience being small-minded. You know, if you're gossiping, you experience the fear that gossip brings about, you know. So the negative is you experience whatever you're doing negatively, and you experience whatever you're doing positively. And so it's in my best interest, regardless of whether a person is giving back to me, is to keep on giving, keep on caring. Those are our dharmas, and they have their own reward that is really free of what the person gives back to us. So if we feel like bitter or angry or worn out or tired, you know, because we're not getting anything back, then we have to, I'd say, do some inner child work. Because you are needing something back, and you're being a good little girl or a good little boy, you know, and nobody's noticing, you know. Nobody's giving back to you. Nobody's telling you how good you are. There's something, you know, how generous you are, how kind you are. Nobody's, you know, telling you that. And so you probably haven't been told that enough when you're little. You need to be told that, you know. I'm trying so hard and still nobody's telling me I'm good. And you, so I don't know if that's what it is, but it's certainly worth asking, you know. Why really do you feel so angry, you know? What is it that you're really wanting? What is it that you really need? Especially if you think you're not asking for anything. If you know that you're asking for something from the other person and they just continually refuse to give it, and you need that in order to be happy, then you're going to be irritated and angry and, you know, and bitter and all of this. But say you, until you learn not to be, you know. But say you don't think that you're asking for anything, and then you're still feeling that way. To me, that means you're asking for something. You want something. And it's good to just be with yourself and ask, you know, what is it that I really want? You know, you really want an acknowledgement, you know. And remember when I said that Kohut, he said that mirroring is the oxygen of the psyche. And so say I do something kind for you, then you want that to be acknowledged. I give you something and then you're grateful and happy, you know, and smile and everything. And then it feels like the circuit has been completed. And there's a certain mirroring there, but say I do something for you, I give something to for you, and you just walk off. There's no acknowledgement. Then there's no mirroring. Right? And so just in normal, everyday reality, that is going to be disconcerting, you know, and kind of irritating, hurtful, because I'm not being mirrored back. My goodness or my love is not being mirrored back. And so then I feel hurt. Right? And so then I would say, that's right. So we want to start to realize more and more our own independence, that my giving or my loving or my caring is really my dharma, and it has its own reward. You know, instead of needing too much for other people to acknowledge it. Not to say it's not good, nice to be acknowledged. It's nice to be acknowledged, but if you really depend on it, then there's strings attached. You know. Does that make sense? No. No. There's many levels to all these questions, so we can talk about it in a lot of different ways. Can you say some words about how Jesus is seen from a Vedantic perspective? Can you say that he was some kind of a Brahmanishta? I don't really think there's a Vedantic perspective on Jesus in terms of some of the people writing about him, or if anything, in terms of a cultural perspective, they will view Jesus and Muhammad and the Buddha and all the great spiritual leaders as avatars. In their great generosity, they see any spiritual leader who's been had a major kind of following and footprint in the world to be an avatar, like Krishna and Rama. And they will even, so this isn't Vedanta, this is just the Hindu culture, they'll even put pictures of Muhammad and Jesus and Buddha on their altar, you know, as avatars of our time. Of our time means within, that are, their presence is still meaningful to many people. They'll praise them and worship them as avatars, even though they don't necessarily know much about the religion or anything like that. They know that the many people worship Jesus as an embodiment of God, you know. And they don't worship, Muhammad isn't considered an embodiment, like an avatar of God, but nevertheless, he's the main person of that religion, Buddha also. So still they view them in that way. And so maybe one thing, Vedantically or culturally, to realize that in Hinduism, God takes many, many forms. Ishwara, just as an avatar, where Ishwara takes a form to fulfill a certain dharma at a particular time, you know. And so the way that you worship God or whoever is your God fits right into that Hindu religion. That's why they don't have any problems. And that's why they kind of generously welcome all different religions into the Hindu fold. The problem is that a lot of the religions that they welcome in don't have the same attitude. Like a Christian, you know, you have to become a Christian to go to heaven. A Hindu, that's inconceivable. They would never think like that. They would think, you're worshiping God in this form, that's the form that you worship God in, you know. So they wouldn't see that I'm better than you. You're worshiping Bhagawan in this way. Or Muhammad, you're worshiping Allah, you're worshiping God in the form of Allah. That's your religion, you know. And so they love it and respect it, and we invite you in, you're a religious person, all of that. But these Western religions are converting religions, and so they don't have that feeling. They feel that you have to convert to be saved, and the Muslim faith is at least the way it's being portrayed now. I'm not talking about the terrible, terrible radicals. But, you know, you are a heathen if you're not a Muslim in one way or another. So they certainly don't want you to change to be not a Muslim. And they think that you should convert into being a Muslim. It's different. It's a different kind of a mindset than Christianity, but still it's that converting religions. So say you welcome converting religions into your fold, and you yourself are not a converting religion. So Buddhism is not either. Judaism is not. These are not the non-converting religions. They're safe to welcome into your fold. But the others are wolves in sheep's clothing, you know. You welcome them into your fold, but their feeling is you need to become a Christian, or you need to become a Muslim. You're doing an act against God. So that's an interesting dilemma. And it's only really been relatively recently that the Hindus themselves have understood that. Now there's a lot of things written about it, you know. Swamiji did a lot on that. He wrote a book called Conversion is Violence and has talked around the world about this because he felt like the Hindu religion was being destroyed by these converting religions, and he felt it was a terrible, really act of violence against a people and a culture and their religion. I don't think a Vedantin would view Jesus as a Jnani or a Brahmanishta. I think they would. There's not enough. Well, let me put it this way, to give all the benefit of the doubt. In the New Testament, there's not enough in there, except a few phrases here and there, to make you think that he has knowledge, nor is there any self-knowledge, nor is there any real teaching in the New Testament. So you have to go to the Nag Hammadi and different, the Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that to read some of these ancient texts where they tell you kind of more about his beliefs. And from the studies that I've done and that people who know much more than me have done, his beliefs more fall in line with Gnosticism than with Vedanta. But that's something to be studied, you know. The Christian religion, as it's been handed down, is not very good. But within every religion has its mysticism. There's Christian mysticism, there's the Sufis, Islamic mysticism, you know, the mystic Kabbalah, the Jewish mysticism. And there's much more in common with the mystics of any given religion than with the dogmas and the rituals. Much more in common. They can talk to each other, they can understand each other. Because when we use this word mystic, what makes them a mystic is that they want a direct relationship with Bhagavan, with God. Not just a dogma and a catechism. They want to actually know God, to be in union with God. You know? And so then if you read their writings within the different traditions, then you can see commonality, you know, between all of the religions. In fact, Houston Smith, he's kind of a well-known, almost a popular religious scholar, you know. And he made a graph that looks like a triangle like that. At the bottom of the triangle, he put all of the religions like Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, etc., all of them lined up. And then at the top, there's this little square. And at this top part was the mystical traditions of all of these. So it all went up like this. So at this point, up here at the top, they all kind of converged. And they could all communicate. It's not even that they were saying the same thing, but they were talking about the same thing. You know, there's a lot of similarity. But down at the bottom, all of the dogmas were very, very different one from the other. They didn't have much in common. So say if you're studying these religions down at a dogma level, then you wouldn't be thinking in terms that are similar to what, say, the Vedanta has to say. Because it's all within kind of duality, and you probably wouldn't resonate very well with it, depending upon how you were taught. Because again, there's many types of Christianity, there's many types of Judaism, many types of Islam, and you can be in a small community of almost any religious variant where you feel much more comfortable in terms of the religion being a loving, supportive religion and not a condemning religion. Anyway. You're asking me questions I don't know very much about. Funny question, sorry. Considering we all are one, what is the value of worshiping the gods, and why many different gods? In India, almost anything can have a deva. And so, in fact, Swamiji has said this, and he's talked about it in one of the discussions that we have online. You know, in those dialogues that we have with Swamiji online. He's talked about that in this infinite order, there are an infinite number of laws. And so all of those laws exist within Ishwara. They're part of the body of Ishwara. You can look at any law as a devata. You know, so anywhere that you find order, there's a law controlling something, you know, then that law is often, that order is often, has a devata attached to it. And so in that way, there can be literally countless number of devatas. But the major devatas in India that everyone knows of, some of them come from the Vedas, they are, most of them, the Vedic devatas are looking at big powers like Agni is the devata of fire, Vayu is the devata of the wind. Surya is the devata of the sun. Chandra is the devata, you know, of the moon. And then Varuna is the devata of the waters. Prithvi is the devata of the earth. And so they all have stories also, you know. And so then you can get into different kinds of devatas like Ganapati, who has Shiva's son, and Parvati, who has a lot of stories around him. Ganapati is the devata of obstacles. So you can pray to Ganapati. Always, you know, Ganapati is everybody's friend. Because Ganapati will, if you pray, this is getting in my way of this obstacle, this is, can please help me, please remove these obstructions. So there's prayers, and you say a prayer to Ganapati. He may even be your Ishta Devata, that devata that you feel most resonant with, you know. Or say Shiva can be your Ishta Devata. Shiva can be the Ishta Devata for many sannyasis because Shiva is responsible for destruction. And so we want our ignorance destroyed. Shiva is responsible for really bringing the creation into Laya, into unmanifest condition, you know. So destroying it, in a sense. So what if I want my ajnanam, I want moksha, I want my ignorance destroyed? You know, and so there are for everything, just about everything that every law that takes place, there's going to be a devata. Even the ashwins are devatas for health, or the doctors, you know. So every law, everything that's in order will have a devata. And then say for you as a person, if it's not passed down from your parents, and maybe you're a Westerner and you've kind of found yourself in kind of the Hindu fold, some devatas, and maybe Jnaneshwari. I love Jnaneshwari because she's the goddess of knowledge, and she's there, you know, in the Dakshinamurti temple, And we're women, those of us who are women, Yanishwari, has a very beautiful meaning, you know, and so maybe she's very close to my heart, you know. Or maybe I also love Ganesha. You might find there's one or more, or maybe you feel very close and connected to Dakshinamurti or to Saraswati, you know. That just depends on you, and also what you need to invoke. You might have an Ishta Devata. That means you're special, that which, you know, is most close to you. But then you may need something and think, Ganapati could help me with that, you know. Then you would say some prayers and invoke Ganapati. Or you can just evoke Ishwara, you know, Bhagavan, who is all of them. So it's just, there isn't that concept. There's a concept of one Ishwara, but that one Ishwara has many parts. And those parts are devatas, you know. So they have their own embodiment, their own deva form that you can invoke. Is that an answer to that? Considering we all are one, what is the value in worship the gods, and why many different gods? The value, we're all one, but within this world, this body is different from this body is different from this body, right? So within this world, there is duality. And what if within this world, you as a jiva, you know, need help, or you want Bhagawan's grace, or you want Bhagawan or a devata to be walking with you as your friend, looking after you, you know, and so someone who has more power than you do, somebody who can take care of things, somebody who can bless you, somebody who can look out for you, then you'll, and you're religious in that way, spiritual in that way, then you can find yourself having a relationship with Ishwara, where you as a jiva have a relationship with the whole, part of the whole, or you have a relationship, prayerful relationship with Bhagawan in a particular form. That form which is designated to help in this particular situation, you know, and so it's not necessary. I mean, even for a jnani, you can still have, just like I can have a relationship with you, right? Why can't I have a relationship with Ganapati or with Jnaneshwari on a subtle level? It doesn't mean that we're not just one. It doesn't mean that I've become an ajnani. Because I have a relationship with you, I haven't become an ajnani. You know, we can have a really deep relationship. It doesn't make you an ajnani. You can have a deep relationship with an Ishta Devatas. Or an Ishta Devata doesn't make you an ajnani. Because this is mitya, that is mitya, and the relationship is mitya, and what you desire is mitya also. But being a jnani doesn't mean that you can't participate in the world. It means you can participate really fully in the world, because you don't need the world to make you happy. So that means you can engage in the world. You can engage with people really deeply, because you've given them tremendous freedom. I can be with you and I can really enjoy your presence, and if you leave, that's fine. It's not like, and because I enjoy being with you, you kind of have to stay. And not only that, you not only have to stay, you have to stay as you are now. Not going to happen. So the more wholeness in your own being, that ananda, which is so steady, is there, manifest in your mind. Manifest in your mind means that viveka is there, your presence is never covered by your experiences, by the vrittis, your presence is never covered. And when that's the case, then people have tremendous freedom to just be themselves and to come and go and do what they need to do. And you enjoy letting them have that freedom too. You know, you enjoy not clinging. There's so much freedom in not clinging, whatever it is. So you more and more just love to not cling and to let things be as they are. Let Ishwara be as he is. Let me just do my part, what's being asked of me now. I'll do that the best of my ability. I don't have to have it be a particular way. I just do to the best of my ability and let things move on. Let Bhagawan be Bhagawan. So that gives so much freedom. But there's no thing that I can't love Ganapati or Jnaneshwari or you know, love to chant and love to evoke and have a relationship with the deities. Why shouldn't I do that? There's not any reason. I think it's all very positive, actually. It's very spiritual, religious. You have a good, nice family of beings that are close to you. And it's good. Can you please explain more about the relationship between the Buddhi, and the Atma and their functioning together? Okay, I think I know what you mean by that. The mind, which has many types, many qualities, has four basic categories of vrittis, right? It's the fluctuating mind, then the jnana vrittis, the buddhi, clarity of thinking, then the negative thoughts go in the manas, then the memory, then the ahankara. And then there's also all of the vrittis that come in through sense perception. That's also, the mind is a receptor for that, the manas takes in all of the sensory perception. So the mind itself, with all of its different categories of thought or emotion, each thought is or thought flow we call a vritti. So each mental experience you have is a vritti. Every vritti, because it's sattva of sattva, rajas, and tamas in the maya, reflects or allows for the manifestation, you know, or allows itself to be an upadi, you know, for the Atma, for the self. Every vritti without exception feels itself to be the conscious being. It's mitya. But because it's sattva and as though reflects consciousness, it takes itself to be the conscious being. Okay, so now, because sattva, as opposed to something which is just tamas, like a chair or something, the chair would be an object in a vritti, but from its own standpoint, it doesn't feel like it's a sentient being, right? Because it doesn't have a sukshma sharira, it doesn't have a subtle body. So even though its essential nature is pure being, pure consciousness, it doesn't have a subtle body or a mind that says, I, the chair, am a conscious being, right? Whereas the human being has a mind, which is sattva, which is the reflects consciousness, and so that mind takes itself to be the conscious being. That's ajnanam. That's the condition that every samsari is in. And then I become subject to birth and death and whatever my mind is thinking or feeling, that's who I am and all of this. So now when we bring in the relationship of the buddhi, you know, to the Atma, from the standpoint of the jnani, as I've been talking about it, so I think that's probably what the question is referring to. The buddhi is category of vrittis that have knowledge. And so it's the buddhi that has self-knowledge. It's the buddhi that is able to differentiate itself from its being, from its truth, the Atma. The buddhi is able to do that because it has self-knowledge. And so the buddhi recognizes, it's just like the jnani pot recognizes the clay as its being, and the clay is also free of its being. It knows that. And so the jnani buddhi recognizes me, the Atma, as I am in my own nature, as its being, and as being also free of time and space and free from whatever is categorized as mitya, including the buddhi. So the buddhi knows. And now the buddhi knowing is able to, say in doing inner child work, for instance, the buddhi is able to speak for me. You know, if the buddhi is rooted in me, it knows me, it recognizes me, then and is with me, as opposed to being overwhelmed by an emotion or overwhelmed by anger, and then it's speaking for the anger, or it's speaking for the hurt, or it's speaking from the distress, or it's speaking from the depression, whatever, or it's speaking from the compassion, now that would be more close to my own nature. Right? So that would be resonant. So anyway, the buddhi then, in terms of self, in terms of having self-knowledge, Atma doesn't have a voice. Its voice, right? Its voice and its thoughts are take place in the buddhi, which is mitya, but the mitya buddhi has me as itself. So when the buddhi has knowledge and is awake to me, you know, and knows, understands the creation as mitya, and knows very fully that the ananda that we get glimpses of in the creation is just moments of shanti in my mind, which make the mind feel happy, the real ananda being only existing as my own self. So when that knowledge is really clear, the buddhi's orientation toward the world is an orientation based upon its knowledge, what it knows. And not just the knowledge, its knowledge, but also the what is the natural affect or the natural nature, the nature of my being, which is ananda, the nature of my being. The sat, you know, being itself, my own amness, is consciousness. And it's not that it has an affect, just like consciousness is not an affect of being. Being is consciousness. But then, what am I like? What is conscious being like? Is it like space, which is totally neutral and not very exciting? I'm affect-free like space. That's not it. This me is its own unique fullness, ananda, purnatvam, you know? To know what it is, that's why we have to just to know myself, to recognize myself and realize through the recognition of myself that in fact there is nothing more dear, nothing more beautiful, nothing more amazing than my own simple, unassuming being. There's nothing more. And so my buddhi recognizes that, knows that, speaks from that, you know, abides in that, speaks from that, as opposed to speaking from an emotion or speaking from ajnanam or speaking from raga dvesha. You know, I'm abiding in myself and speaking from myself. And so in that way, the buddhi, thinking from myself, speaking from myself, acting from myself, from the standpoint of the upadis, because my buddhi is resting in me as opposed to resting in some other mitya or ajnanam. And so then the buddhi becomes very, very helpful. In inner child work, it's very helpful. You are with the self, and you are caring for the hurt child, you know. Or your mind is hurt for whatever reason. You are resting in yourself, the buddhi, and that buddhi, with that the affect that is your own being, if I can use that word affect, an affect that never comes and goes, the very nature of your swarupa, your nature, it's your very nature, then you are taking care of the mind, you know, the conscious mind. You're taking care of the little ones. You're the one who is with your students. You are the one who's with your family. You're the one who's with the animals. You're the one that's with anyone in the universe. You're the one who's with Ishwara. And because you're coming from yourself. And that's why the jnani who has jnana nishta means that the problems and all of the inner child stuff and the immaturities that we have had enough time to more or less drop off in the light of your knowledge. They drop off in their own time. You know, once they've dropped off, then other people don't have to suffer them. You don't have to suffer them. Other people don't have to suffer them. And so, when you're with a jnani, you're with somebody that knows you. The feeling is, because I used to feel this as Swamiji, the feeling is that they know you better than you know yourself. You know? You feel so completely held. Because there's nothing between the self, for Jnani, there's nothing between the self and their buddhi. The buddhi isn't overwhelmed by raga dvesha or overwhelmed by a reaction or something. So you're just simply you and your being. It's very beautiful, you know. And then now there's nothing clouding it. I used to feel when Swamiji would walk around the ashram in Salersburg, which has all these tall trees, you know, these tall pine trees and redwoods, whatever. And a lot of birds and beautiful flowers and things. There's beautiful gardens there. I would just kind of see them all perk up. When he would land, when he would come into the ashram, it's like all of the whole ashram, everything would just perk up. Well, it's like everybody was so happy that he'd arrived, even the plants and the grass and the trees, you know, that ananda, that love had come. When the love comes, then you feel loved. It's not love that comes, it's being loved comes, and everyone then feels loved, you know. Just like we use the word is known, then everything is known, is loved. Everything is loved. Because that's that completed state of the self, and so when your psyche is, as it over time it sorts out its hurts and complexes that kind of cast shadows from the standpoint of the mind or the psyche, it's casting some shadows, not from the standpoint of your being. But when those shadows are not there anymore, you know, then the whole world in that comes in your wake feels loved. Not because you're loving, but because that's your nature. So that makes it very unthreatening, because he's not doing anything. He's just being himself, you know. And there's no obstacles inside to get in the way of that. So it used to make people very, very happy to be in his presence. Even when he was just sitting there reading the paper, which he would do in the satsang. Somebody bring him a paper, some paper that from India that they would run off in very big print as he got older, you know, run it off and print it out. They'd bring him this big wad of printed paper and, you know, like 25-point type or whatever. We'd just sit there around, hanging out, watching him read his paper. Mm-hmm. Be totally concentrated on it, totally into it, you know. So there's nothing else there except this paper. We just sit there really smiling. Yeah. So. Can you talk about the vision? I did. Didn't I? Yeah. I talked about it today because I remembered that. Oh, you're all questioning. Questioners. It's your doing. Can you talk more about the buddhi and its connection with consciousness? I think I just did that, didn't I? I feel that's what I was just talked about. You have to remember sattva, you know. To understand the buddhi or the connection of the vritti with consciousness is to understand sattva, because sattva reflects consciousness, you know, and so that's why it can take itself to be the conscious being. And then whatever the buddhi or the mind identifies with or through the sense organs, you know, reflects, like for instance, the sense organs, which are also sattva, the sense of touch runs through the whole body. And so therefore this body then enjoys consciousness. So it's not just the buddhi that enjoys consciousness, it's the sattva, whatever is sattva. So the whole antakarana, the whole mind reflects consciousness because of sattva. Sense organs reflect consciousness because of sattva. So wherever the sattva lands, like through the sense organs, that, you know, will be reflecting consciousness. The buddhi, as the deepest or the innermost instrument. It's innermost even to the manas, because it comments on the manas. It comments on the memory. So the memory doesn't comment on the buddhi. The buddhi comments on the manas. or in the memory, chitta also. And the ahankara is often something which is identifying with all three, but is often placed in the buddhi. Right? So it's not that the buddhi has a unique relationship with consciousness. Sattva has a unique relationship with consciousness. The buddhi is sattva, and then there is that relationship with consciousness that is there naturally for all sattva, and then the buddhi has its own characteristics. The buddhi is that type of that category of thought which is knowledge-based, where there's clarity, where there's understanding, where there's determination, where there's it's unwavering knowledge, there's certainty, you can act on it. Where the manas is just either thought flow, the doubting mind, I don't know to do this, is it that, is that. There's no way to act on the manas. There's emotions. There's no way to act on the emotions from the standpoint of the manas. There's just emotions there. But the buddhi is the one that comes into relationship. And that's what we're talking about. Like, your buddhi has that capacity to come into relationship with whatever type of reaction or whatever type of feeling or whatever type of situation is there. It can come into a very healing relationship with that once it objectifies it. The buddhi can also be overwhelmed by emotion, or overwhelmed by ajnanam, ignorance, or overwhelmed by your likes and dislikes. And then the buddhi is not speaking from the self, it's speaking from, it's lost. It's as though lost in a dream. It's lost in that emotion. And then that emotion is speaking through the buddhi rather than the buddhi objectifying the emotion and speaking. So what's so powerful about your buddhi is that it can do that. It can actually come into relationship with any situation that you're in, any emotion that's going on, any rumblings, any type of thing, and bring your knowledge to that experience. And the knowledge is not just the knowledge of Vedanta, about the freedom of my own being and everything is Ishwara and however we talk like that. It's also knowledge in terms of antakarana shuddhi, karma yoga, taking everything as prasad, that prasada buddhi, taking everything as prasad, as a gift from Ishwara, positive or negative, take it as a prasad, as an offering from the temple, as an offering from Ishwara. Inner child work, you know, inner friend. This is all knowledge. And the buddhi has that knowledge and can utilize that knowledge. In many, you have, the knowledge is not just one thing. You have many ways of now of handling difficult situations. So the buddhi is capable of doing that. And jnana nishtha really is being well-rooted in your own being. But it's, you know, it's also the buddhi has the knowledge, is strong enough that that knowledge trumps anything else. It's stronger than anything else that comes your way. That's the nishtha. There's a commitment there. But the commitment is not, I'm going to be committed to the buddhi. It's the buddhi has the strength. It has become strong enough, you know, to not lose itself when emotions and traumas and hard things rise up. The buddhi is already, it's strong enough. So it stays with its, knowledge. Not because it's, let me stay with my knowledge. Yeah. It's because your knowledge is strong enough. And then, as it becomes stronger and stronger, what you notice is that you're not being overwhelmed as often. Because when you get overwhelmed by your emotions and that type of thing, and that overwhelm has taken place, there's some time gap before it settles down enough for your buddhi to even want to objectify and to come in, come to the rescue, you know. So it takes a while sometimes for that emotional upheaval to settle down before you can really bring in your knowledge or even want to do inner child work or want to do anything that would be really useful, because you're just overwhelmed. And so you then also, may remember to, when that's the case, just kind of welcome it into yourself and allow it to be. But that even you have, that's also knowledge. You might not even have that knowledge. You might just be drowning in the emotion for a while until it's kind of like until the tide pulls out. Yeah, and then your buddhi is there, still functioning, but it's not so overwhelmed, so it can come and be helpful, you know. So maybe the relationship. Is this another question? Oh, and I can't see besides that with the glasses. I think that does it, and its connection to consciousness. Yeah. Okay. Where do the intuitions and premonitions come from? Well, I think how Swamiji would answer that, which I see it this way too, Buddha Swamiji, is that the kind of like this, you have a huge, unimaginable amount of data coming in through your sense organs and your experiences all the time. Way, way more than your conscious mind can handle. And so there's a huge filter taking place of what your conscious mind only takes in what it needs to deal with. Otherwise, you couldn't manage because you're taking in so much. That means, though, that your unconscious has so much knowledge, way more than the conscious mind is even aware of, because all of this data has to circumvent the conscious mind in order for you to be able to function. So there's a huge amount of knowledge just contained in the psyche itself, from your experiences, you know. And now say, there's something that's happening out in the environment that triggers, this is like a premonition, you know, because we do have premonitions. That's another thing with the premonitions. We have them all the time, but we often don't listen to them. And then you, premonition, it's like a foresight. Okay. You have a sense that something's going to happen. It can be good or bad, but it's a sense, and often it'll just kind of, for most of us, I think, it just kind of wafts through, and it'll waft through and you don't pay attention. You even notice it, and you know that you could. Even sometimes I know that I should pay attention, and I don't, so many times. And then I tell myself after that thing has actually happened, I wish I should have listened. Why don't I listen? You know? Because I knew it came through, but I don't pay attention. Because I think we're just not really trained to pay attention, because we don't know for sure. It's just this feeling, seeing that wafts through. Those are premonitions. But those are all, you have so much knowledge in your psyche, and those understandings are triggered in the environment, and something rises up. You know, that's one way of looking at it. And with intuitions we look at a little bit differently. It's like, say you're studying something. You're studying it, like Einstein, you know, when he would study these formulas and trying to figure out some mathematical equation. Of course, he'd be working on it and working on it and working on it. But he would never get it. He wrote about this. He would never get it. It would always be given to him, either in a dream, or it would just come to him one morning as he was waking up. Poof, there he is. He sees the whole thing, you know. And so that's the unconscious working on all of these things, giving you the answers, skipping all of the logical steps, because it was handling all of those logical steps internally in the psyche, and then it just gives you the result, like putting something in the oven and then it comes out, you know, all done and all nicely cooked and everything. So Swamiji's talked about, you know, intuition in that way. Another thing he said that is along the same lines in reference to Sanskrit, which I've also found to be true, and it was, he found it to be true for himself. He says, you just study Sanskrit. I mean, it's a huge grammar, a huge vocabulary. You just study it every day. You know, and then even on the days when you're not studying or when you're away from it, your psyche is still working on it. Your psyche never stops working on it. And so you're learning Sanskrit even when you're not studying, you know. So I like that because I found that to be true. Learning goes on, you know. You have a commitment to something, you're studying something, you're taking all of the stuff in the psyche, your conscious mind's not really, it's not really gelling, but it's all working itself out internally. And so it's not just a process of you have to Ramaha, Rama, Rama, all this, you know. That's not enough, actually. In order for that language to come embodied, the psyche has to do a lot of work. It has to become deeply embodied in you, fingertip, like there's no distance at all or no memory involved between you and your knowledge. Just like when we're speaking English, it's not like I have to remember what is the word for this body. Okay. There's no memory. It's totally assimilated in the psyche. Your psyche has a lot of work to do, and it's doing that work 24/7. So that's a little bit I know about intuition. One more, if it's not too long. Oh, what is transmigrating from life to life? Too long. But that question I will answer also, I hope, in the class. But can you talk about Ishwar? Too long. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me just tell you a couple of words about transmigration. Remember I talked about the sukshma sharira, the subtle body? The subtle body that's made of the five pranas, the five karmendriyas, the five jnanendriyas, the organs of action and organs of sense, and then the four aspects of the buddhi. Those 19 components, four aspects of the antakarana, those 19 components comprise the subtle body. Okay, it is the subtle body that transmigrates, taking body after body after body, based upon your karmas. Okay. So you have a storehouse of karmas called the sanchitta. Those sanchitta karmas are karmas that they're the subtle results of your actions that have not yet fructified, and they're in the form of punya and papa, right? And so out of the sanchitta karma comes the prarabdha karma, which is the karma that you use for this life, takes you from birth to death, and that karma is determined by the moment of your death. Who are you? What is the combination of punya and papa that you're carrying? What is your essence? Not in terms of Brahman, but in terms of as you as a jiva, the good and bad you've done, the things that are meaningful to you at this moment of death. What do you take with you? And that person that you are at the moment of death will attract the sanchitta karmas that are appropriate for your continuation into the next life and maybe also into some different higher and lower lokas just to exhaust some karmas, but the continuation into that life. And that process goes on and on and on. And while you're in this particular life, which is the exhausting of the prarabdha, you're also accruing a bunch of new karmas that have subtle results, punya and papa, that go into the sanchitta. That will be gathered, so you have like an infinite batch of sanchitta karmas, but you're only going to be drawing on those particular karmas that are appropriate for your continuation from this life at the moment of death to your next life. Just like this, when I go to bed at night, right, you can look at that as kind of a death, and it's me that has to wake up and go on to the next day, right? So there's a continuation. So think of life like that. There's this whole life that has its own logic from birth to death, But then from a different perspective, this is just one day in the life of many lives. So there's this one life, then there's the next life and the next life. And that has its own logic, its own continuation. It's not just random, you know. You're moving on. And the karma, and you, who you are attracting the karmas that are appropriate for your next life. So it goes like that. I could get into a lot more detail. Maybe we'll have time, but that's basically what it is. The Atma does not transmigrate. Yourself doesn't transmigrate, but the sattva that makes up the sense organs in the mind, you know, continues to reflect you, whether it's, and to have manifest you, whether it's in this life or the next life or the next life. So that sukshma sharira is never without you. That's why you think, well, I transmigrate. Because the subtle body, the sattva, will continue to reflect you, and you are pervasive to the entire, you're the being, the self of the entire creation on every level. There's no place in the creation where you are not. You are the adhishtana of the entire creation. So wherever the jiva goes, traveling around, doing this, that, I am there, right? So you won't have any sense of death. There is no sense of death because the Atma never dies. It's free of time. And the sukshma sharira doesn't die either. It travels. The only time the sukshma sharira comes to an end is when your whole being, the body, mind, sense organs, and your whole mind is finished. It's because it's resolved into your being, into the wholeness of your being. There's nothing in you that has any interest whatsoever in transmigrating. That gasoline has been used up. You know, if you want to transmigrate, if you're a thought, I need one more life so that I need to do this and that and this. Okay, you can have that. Then you might say, yeah, I still need one more. Okay, no problem. There comes a time when you don't need one more, you don't want one more. It's totally irrelevant to you, to the wholeness of your being. It's like when you're really, really happy or really complete, you don't think, okay, let me go out and do this too. You just hope this wholeness doesn't go away, you know? Don't move. Nobody move. Nobody say anything. Should we say a prayer? Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Go Brahmane Vyashubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Shobarahitah Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhak Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi
Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha. Harihi Om.